Okay. Okay, good to see everybody. First of all, that clock is slow and it misleads me, so I have to follow the proper clock set by the Israeli radio. Today is Monday morning, the 5th of November, 2012, and here we sit, beautiful weather, no floods, and if you talk with anyone on the eastern seaboard, you get some story of horror. Now, just following up last week's lecture, which has aroused interest all over the world, most of it positive, some of it negative, which is everyone's prerogative. I even was asked this morning, maybe the Rav would have changed his mind in the year 2012. And although I've made a living out of giving lectures on the Rav's change of mind from Aguda to Mizrahi, and I've published a great deal in my tapes, 9 hours, the best seller the OU ever had with any tapes they ever issued. Yes, the Rav changed his mind, but that's about the only major topic I know of where the Rav changed his mind. But on this issue with feminism in the synagogue and homosexuality, the Rav was very powerful and very strong. I heard it from him many times. And I hesitantly, I believe I was more lenient than the Rav when I spoke about B'dievet. I won't tell a rabbi not to take a shtela if the women will go and make their own prayer group or they want to dance with the Torah and Simchas Torah, as long as it's not in the shul proper. I hope Rebbe would agree with me, but I'm quite certain he did not change his mind. That many proofs to his own family and their own attitude. If you know about Atara, Dr. Atara Tversky made it tonight with Rabbi J.J. Schachter when he took over the Soloveitchik Institute, that he can only head the institute if he will not ever allow a feminine prayer group in any synagogue he's associated with, something to that effect, a tanai like that. And that's a pretty strong tanai to make. So what I'm very happy about is that my student Steve Gross sent me information, and this is very important. This is a draft of a major paper by Graham Fitzpatrick on homosexuality, the 10% homosexual and lesbian myth, and this is a scholarly paper with research all over the world. When you study it and read it, you'll see that perhaps the real homosexuals who haven't gotten help yet is perhaps only 1% or at the very most 2% of the population. And that goes from the USA, goes for England, goes for Australia. And you might have more bisexuals, but that's the result of making it normative. In England, you can't work for the BBC. And I don't want to use, unless you've experimented. What's fabulous is the New York Times just had an article. I don't see it in front of me unless I've had so many articles I'm running around with. The New York Times just had an article, and the New York Times published it, about, here it is, about former ex-gay that disappeared October 31st, 2012, by Eric Eckholm. Ex-gay men fight back against view that homosexuality can't be changed. And here's an article in the New York Times with interviews with people who went for help, etc. So, okay, the issue hangs fire. The issue has exploded again as an afterthought of the tragedy in the United States. And there I have to say, I expressed myself privately. I'll explain in 1 second. That I expressed myself privately that Kadosh Baruch Hu is going to wipe out part of the world. And I quoted the Gemara in Sanhedrin in Chelek that the Makkah B'Patish that brought about the flood was homosexual behavior. And it's not only a Gemara, it's a Medrash Rabbah. And I said it privately. I said a Kadosh Baruch Hu said he won't destroy the whole world, but who knows what he'll do to part of the world. So if you go to the websites, go to Vasas Nice, a very simple website. It began 2 days ago. Some Chabad rabbi opened his mouth and said exactly what I said, but said it publicly. Now on the website, it's tens of rabbis have opened their mouths. Pastors, ministers, everyone saying exactly what I said. And the governor Pataki, ex-governor, attacked this rabbi bitterly. You have to see it to believe it. So I stand, that's it.
Did these people ever read the book of Theo? Were the friends of Theo coming to have a reason for why he's suffering?
You understand, that's why Yitzchak, relax yourself. That's why I never said it aloud. But I'm amazed to see what I was thinking is now in the public thoroughfare. But no. Look, open up the Rambam Hilchat Tshuva, and you'll see what the Rambam says based upon the Gemara, that when tragedy comes upon you, you have to think, what have I done wrong? So it's interesting that Obama and same-sex comes to the fore again, and the issue will not go away. Yasher Koyach Gadol, do you want this back? Yasher Koyach Gadol. He said it and he did it. He's a Talmud of Aaron Rakefet. Next, Yitzchak Rubin wanted a source yesterday. It's Perik Bet in Avodah Zarah, Daf Lamed Vav Amid Aleph. And that's the main source on the difference between Yayin, Stam Yainam, and Stam Shemin. Okay? Also, yes? Well, I can't just say. Yeah. Belittle which approach? Listen. None of us are God. That's all I'm willing to say. But in cold or deed of fake, it's an overpowering statement. But I don't know what you're talking about. The cold or deed of fake is not to say the Eev. That's what Rabbi Rubin just said. But with Eev and everything behind us, there is a Rambam in Hilchat Tshuva that is very, very, very important. That when a person sees that God is punishing him, he has to think, what am I doing wrong? But it's fascinating because Governor Pataki ripped apart the Chabadnik, and now there are about another 10, 11 rabbis. I saw item after item coming in and saying exactly the same thing. And I'm crying, I'm laughing. I'm crying because of the tragedy is overwhelming. If you speak with anyone on the Eastern Seaboard, this is not a joke. This is overwhelming. People don't know when they'll get back electricity. People's homes were totally swept away. People have nowhere to go. The freezing weather is coming in. You have no idea. I spoke with people, friends of mine. One friend has a summer home on the ocean. His whole, where the boats go from in his backyard, totally swept away. The whole, what's it called? The dock. It's like a little boardwalk. Totally swept away. The fence on his property, totally swept away. Total flooding in his basement. But he says he's lucky. Friends of his, their homes disappeared. Sheepshead Bay, Rabbi Shulson, davened for the Chabad house. So Rabbi Shulson told me the Chabad, the house, which was one story, doesn't exist anymore. Totally swept away. He went and they davened in the rabbi's living room, which is like the second or third floor. And this is all over. Mordechai Ben David, Seagate, his house totally gone. All his recordings, all his music, all his archives, totally gone. And multiply this 1,000, 10,000 times, 100,000 times over. Imagine no one can travel. I have a friend who's not in good health. None of his children can visit him. No one has gas to get into Manhattan. People had to go to New York Hospital, big specialist, appointments months in advance. They were told, the hospital is gone, they evacuated the hospital. You saw that on Israeli TV, it's beyond words. So anyway, I don't want to minimize, but you know, to say we can't play God is very nice. On the other hand, medaf tan tshuva, and to me it's frightening that the President of the United States takes a point of view like that in public, and the governor and the mayor of New York, it's beyond words. In my humble opinion, okay. Now, one second. Oh, so I mentioned in class that when we spoke about RJJ, I mentioned in passing that after his funeral, they cleaned up the New York Police Department, and we never had an anti-Semitic incident again. So my Talmud, Steve Gross, I know about this, but he sent me in the Haaretz, and it was in it's in every newspaper. About a week ago, 2 weeks ago, the police brutally beat someone in a Chabad house in Brooklyn. Isn't this anti-Semitic? So first of all, I want you to understand me. When I say that there was no anti-Semitism in the police department, I mean organized, massive anti-Semitism. That there are always going to be individual anti-Semites around, this goes without saying. But the incident in Crown Heights is not so simple. This was an Israeli who was dead drunk, who was stark naked, and the Chabatnikim, evidently it's a house where if you don't have where to stay, they always give you a bed. It's a basement, whatever it is. It's near 770. And the Chabatnikim called the police at 4 a.m., that there's a naked guy dead drunk on the floor. And when the police came, he started fighting with them. So I wouldn't exactly call it an anti-Semitic incident. Okay, be it as it may, let's get down to work. Isaac Lisa. Now back to Isaac Lisa. I want to thank Nachum Lamb. Sent me the material. I got more material than Isaac Lisa. Nothing changes anything I said in class. What is fascinating is no less than three doctorates have been done in Isaac Lisa. One at Bernard Revel Graduate School in the 60 years ago, one at the University of Pennsylvania 50 years ago, neither were published. The one that was published was the one done at Hebrew Union College in the 1990s. And here I'm holding in front of me an article by the person who did the doctorate on Isaac Lisa at Hebrew Union College, Lance Zussman. And the article is called Isaac Lisa and the Protestantization of American Judaism. And when I read the article, in other words, when you hear the title, you get frightened. What else are they doing to poor Isaac Lisa? Are they turning him into a Protestant? But what the article means is that he made the Orthodox synagogue acceptable to the American scene. He introduced a sermon in English instead of German. He introduced a prayer book with English translation. He introduced a Bible with English translation. So that's what it means, Protestantization, and that's what we spoke about. Okay, let's move on. We dealt with Moshe Weinberg, and a lot of interesting information that came up with Moshe Weinberg. I was sent copies of his the two books that he published, one that I spoke about. In America, they walk on, what was the English name? People Walk on Their Heads. So I now have the original Hebrew edition, and I have also a volume of his drashot. So I'll look at it, and I need time to see Mativo Shel Ubezeh. Who is this Moshe Weinberger? What's fascinating is if you go to the websites, you find that he does have descendants who are evidently in the Torah world because they are sending in comments, we'd like more information on our great-grandfather. Yes, we know about Streitz Matzahs. When all is said and done, everyone boasts that they are related to the man who ultimately gave us the first real matzah bakery in the New York area, Streitz. You got to remember, Manischewitz comes out of Cincinnati, but Streitz out of New York. Now, with all this happening and the Jews pouring into America, and as I told you so many times, the East European Jews come last. The East Europeans, Leben noch in a shtetl, they are living in a ghetto yet. They minret no Yiddish. The East European Jews speak Yiddish. They don't speak German. They don't speak French. They certainly don't speak English. They are more secluded. Until the Civil War, you have very few East European Jews who come to America. Ellie, you follow me? The Civil War, as we've said, then they learn there's an America, things are going on. America is real. But the Jews from Western Europe, Germany, Bavaria, Central Europe, they are coming into America. And finally, the first Rav who has smicha and a Talmud Chacham, Abraham Rice. I gave you his years, 1800, 1862. Rabbi Rice, they just celebrated in Baltimore. Charlie, do you know this? His 150th Yahrzeit. They had recently, 1862, recently, so within the last few weeks, if you correspond with anyone in Baltimore, ask them about it. They evidently had a big scene at his grave, and they evidently had lectures in his memory. And he, from Bavaria, comes to the United States. Why was he willing to come? Number one, he was very close to his Rebbe, Rav Avraham Bing. And you should understand, leaving a Rebbe is one of the hardest parts of leaving a country. Even if you're not a chassid, I'm talking even in a Lithuanian setting, Sam, I can tell you that leaving the Rav was a consideration in my aliyah. It took the six-day war to shake me up, to give me enough guts to do what Bnei Akiva taught me and to leave the United States. And when I said goodbye to Rebbe, I have to tell you, that was a traumatic experience for me. In retrospect, I can only tell you very arrogantly and proudly, and I apologize, when I said goodbye to Rebbe, and I sent him a letter, Rebbe, I'm going to come to see you at your apartment at this time, because I was already teaching, I was in the rabbinate and the rub, and I told him I wanted to take a birchat preda, and I went to see Rebbe in 1969, and his first words to me were, how will you make a living?
That's and that question he asked four, five people.
Okay, that you know of. And the rub was very down to earth. How will you make a living? Not like Rav David Lifshitz. I went to say goodbye to Rav David Lifshitz. He said to me, "Ataloma fached?" And I answered him, I told you, I answered him, "Ani somech al tzahal val hakadosh baruch hu." After living in Israel 44 years, Yosef, I would answer him today, "Ani somech al hakadosh baruch hu val tzahal." I wouldn't have, but he, and then we got into a whole discussion of Yaakov Avinu preparing to meet his brother, to meet Esav, what you do first, etc. Do you pray first, or do you get ready for Milchama first? Ah, but then, I never thought I would see America again. I went in Aliyah, I was a kid, I had the equity of the house I sold, $13,000. That's all the money I had in the world. You have to understand, we're never going to see America again. God did me a miracle. I had enough seichel to buy an apartment right away in Rehavio, and I told people where I live, they look at me, "Wow, it pays to teach Torah, you're a millionaire." Rebbeinu Shlomo, I bought that apartment in 1969. I hate to tell you, it was $13,000 I put into it. The rest of the money ultimately turned into nothing. You remember the story. There was from 69, it was an unlinked mortgage. And unlinked. And what happened was the dollar took off and the lira, the Israeli lira, and within a few years they pleaded with you, pay up the mortgage. It costs more to send you a monthly bill with a stamp than the dollar and a half you'll be paying the mortgage when you're giving them $1,500 the lira. So Rebbeinu Shlomo did miracles for me. Then in 1977, the Jewish agency sent me back, or the government of Israel, to speak at the RCA convention. And here I am, my last conversation with the Rav, how will you make a living? And here I come over to Rebbe at the convention. I had written to him that I'm coming. "Oh, I hear very good things about you, what you're doing in Israel, what you're accomplishing with the youth." I got one compliment after another. And I said to Rebbe, "Rebbe, it's only because of what you taught me and what you inculcated within me." But I walked away thinking, it's a good thing he didn't ask me, "Are you making a living?" Because had he asked that question, the answer would have been no. After the Yom Kippur War, you don't know what it was like here. Now, the story of Rabbi Rice in America is very fascinating. It's very inspiring, but also heartbreaking. He comes to New York. In New York, there were frum Jews. And he's greeted by Rabbi Kuh. I don't want to bore you with all the names, all the details, but there was a Rabbi Kuh that the year he comes to America, 1840. And he comes, lands in New York, he's leaving Europe, his Rebbe had just died, he was willing to leave. There's a beautiful description of their trip on the boat. how they had a kosher stove, they had to pay a little bit more, they had a whole kosher section, they took a Sefer Torah with them. The captain of the ship was very nice, very accommodating, because many Jews came to America, at least on the boat, they still kept kosher. He's met by Reb Yitzchak Ber Krushtit, who was a German immigrant, the Talmud Chacham, who had gone into business, and he appreciated having a rav. Now, what do you do for Stella? So I think I told you they sent them to Newport News. Newport News was in Rhode Island, and it had an Orthodox shul that went back to revolutionary times. It's a tourist attraction until today. It's a government building. You're not allowed to touch it. Binyan Shamur. How do you say that in English? Historic site. Historic site. You're not allowed to change your brick on the building. So Rabbi Reis, his name when he came in America was Mamish Reis. R-E-I-S-V. Later they Americanized it to Reis. Why is Reis more Americanized than Reis? I don't know. But that's the story with his name. So during the summer, it was mobbed. It's out of New York. It's not so hot. It's further north. He sees after the summer, all the balabatim are gone. It's like the Hamptons. Yosef, have you ever been to the Hamptons?
No.
You heard about the Hamptons?
No.
Ah, the Hamptons. That's on the... Today, it's all flooded. Who knows what's there? But the Hamptons, you buy a little house, one room, it's $1 million. A house with 10 rooms already, you're talking $20 million, $30 million, and that's normal. It's on Long Island, the Hamptons, West Hampton, Southampton, it's very famous. A Talmud of mine built the shul there, who learned in this kolo. His father, you heard the name, Rabbi Arthur Schneier, it's Rabbi Arthur Schneier's son, Rabbi Mark Schneier. He's a magician. So they built an Orthodox shul there. So all year, there's 20 people, 30 people, that's all year. Who's going to live on the end of Long Island? They're in the city. These are multimillionaires. But the summer, he puts up two tremendous tents next to the shul. Shabbos morning, you can have 1,000 people davening there. You understand? But after the summer, they're all back in the city. They're gone. Big tents, women, men. Somit microphone system. That's when I saw it for the first time. And it's overwhelming because you don't know there's a microphone. It's overwhelming how that system works on Shabbos. You don't know there's a microphone. It's all over. Microphones and what a system. I don't want to go into the halachic details. But Kol HaKavod at Somet, it was developed for the Israeli Navy. I told you, the Navy must have microphones because there's no other way to communicate on a boat. Today in the Navy, you already have Datiyim. At one time, no religious boy wanted to go into the Navy. Today, you have already, in the officer corps, you have already Kippot, and you have the Somet microphone. They have a Hester unit already in the Navy. Wow. I have cousin at my minyan Friday night, Bob Yesh, his son, what was a seal, you know, in the water. What do you call them? A seal. I don't know if there's a better word for it. He dives. Do you know that he's got a big job today as he's a big attorney? The Navy turned to him and asked him to come back in, and he said no. And if he would have asked me, I would have told him, you go back into the Navy. It's a bigger mitzvah than making money and being a lawyer. But okay, that's Rakefet's point of view. I wish my grandchildren would listen to me and be melamden instead of conquering the world in so many different fields. Aeronautical engineering, with all due respect, Morty, I apologize. Anyway, at the end of the summer, he saw everyone disappear. He was a smart guy, Rabbi Rice. Comes back to New York, he meets a balabas from Baltimore, just by chance. And this balabas knew him from the old country. And Aaron Wegline, that name still exists in the Orthodox world, Wegline. And he tells Rabbi Rice, come to Baltimore. And Rabbi Rice settles in Baltimore. And here he achieves, on one hand, by the way, he spelt this name originally R-E-I-S-S, literally the name of the man who you owe your lives to. The Rabbi Ries runs Yeshivas Rabbi Yisrael Hanan. He's the, what's he called, the dean? Dean of students? All these fellas here, Moshe, in order to come here, Sam, in order to come here, they have to get permission from Rabbi Ries. You follow? He is the king. That was the original name of Rabbi Abraham Ries when he reached Baltimore. In Baltimore, two things happen. One, he makes the community more observant. Until today, you all know that Baltimore is one of the famous Torah communities in the United States. It could even be, I don't know what the statistics are, but it could even be that their percentage of Shmirat Shabbat is higher than any other community, even New York. Even though with Brooklyn you see so many frum Jews, but you got to remember there's Manhattan, there's Staten Island, there's the Bronx, there's Queens. I wouldn't be surprised if Baltimore has a higher percentage, and they all say it goes back to the fact that Rabbi Ries came to Baltimore. Now, what does it mean? He, first of all, a shul, davening, but little matters. You take a sukkah. A sukkah. When he came to Baltimore, there were two, three sukkot. They say, once he started his rabbinate in Baltimore, the next year there were 50 sukkot, the year later 100 sukkot, and Yiddishkeit developed. He tried to open what would be a yeshiva. It didn't have continuity, but he planted the seeds in Baltimore.
What was the name of the shul?
It was close to the Stadtschule. He lived at Albemarle Street, present 5, must mean that the number today is 5, within walking distance of the synagogue. I don't believe that shul exists anymore. It went through merges, and later you'll see at the end of his life, a few years later, I believe the very shul where he was rabbi becomes reform already. But he had a very strong Orthodox presence. Albemarle, let me spell it, A-L-B-E-R-M-A-R-L-E. Do you have a street like that in Baltimore? Do you notice? It was 12, today it's 5. In other words, the numbers of the street changed. Now, what's fascinating about his original years in Baltimore is he becomes an American. Now, what does it mean, becomes an American? On page 84, you have a contemporary question. Tell me, you are almost all Americans, or there, what do we have, an Englishman in this room, so I have to exclude the Russian, I have to exclude the Englishman, but anyone from Canada here? Everyone else is an American. Do you celebrate Thanksgiving Day? Wow, what a question. I'm going to be in New York for Thanksgiving Day. Yeah, I think, yeah, I'm going to be in New York. I'm going to be out of Chicago already, I believe. Do you have turkey? You know about Thanksgiving Day. Turkey, cranberry sauce, what else? What are chestnuts? Pumpkin pie. Min lepta chazishetag on Thanksgiving Day. They're lost. You see, if you don't know Yiddish, you don't know how to curse, and you don't know how to laugh. You follow me, Ephraim? You don't know Yiddish, you don't know how to curse, you don't know how to laugh. Zeleben achasish and tag on Thanksgiving Day. High on the high. So, tell me, are you allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving Day? I want to ask a question. Are you allowed? No? Reb Moshe Feinstein, have you seen, what is it, volume 8? What goes on in the Igrot Moshe, volume 8? Did Reb Moshe allow? Didn't he allow? Totally against it, Chas v'Chalila, Thanksgiving Day. What's the most widely quoted part of my friend Aaron Rakefit's work on the Rav, quoted and quoted again and again? Do you remember the story, right or wrong? Wednesday, 1 year, 1 week, the Rav had a wedding in Boston Tuesday night. So he didn't come into yeshiva. He came Wednesday. Wednesday, 3 o'clock, he finished his shiur, he flew in Wednesday morning, gave shiur 1 to 3. I said, it's like, it happened to me yesterday. And the Rav looks at his watch. Tomorrow we'll have shiur 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock in America? Who's awake at 9 o'clock? It's not Israel. Come on, cut it out. When I have to call America, I shiver and shake if I'm calling them 8:45 New York time. 9 o'clock? And the Rav said, will you be here? Will you be here? And that young guy sitting there, Ani Rothkopf, says, Rebbe, if you say 9 o'clock, we'll be here. But the chutzpah of that Rothkopf, he says, Rebbe, why so early? And the Rav looks at Rothkopf and says, Arnold, you don't know what tomorrow is? It's Thanksgiving Day. I promised my wife will be at my sister by, I think he said, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. In other words, he had to get the 12 o'clock plane. He had to be in Boston, land at 1. Whoever picked him up got him to his sister by 2 o'clock. Shulamit Meiselman or Ann Gerber, whichever sister it was. Which sister do you think it was? Who was the bigger entertainer? You don't know. And from that little episode, you learn that the Rav celebrated Thanksgiving Day. And everyone quotes the Narishkeit I write about on Thanksgiving. What a machlokes. Can you rely on
credibility?
It's a questionable. It's questionable.
But, he doesn't mention it before.
No, there may look through volume 8. There's half the volume is devoted to Thanksgiving Day. It's mind-boggling over one little Thanksgiving Day. I mean, can a zeful kvetchim?
That tells you what day counts.
So Rabbi Rice gave sermons on Thanksgiving Day. How is it possible that our religion should not flourish in this land where we happily enjoy the strongest assurance of complete freedom? Wow. He became an American. He loved America. When William Henry Harrison, it was a very tragic story, was elected President of the United States. Do you remember from your American history? So at the inauguration, he stood without a hat. It was evidently a sign of manliness that you don't wear a hat. No, the inauguration's in January. Could be very cold. He caught a cold, and he died 1 month later from that cold. Who eulogized him? Rice, you can read, beginning on page 84, you can read the entire eulogy, 3 pages long, with such feeling, the President of the United States.
Okay, what are you quoting from?
I'm quoting from what I introduced you to last week. Let me give it to you again. I'm sorry. The first rabbi, okay? It's the doctorate of Rabbi Harold Schaffman. Remember I told you about him last week? He was the younger brother of Rabbi Solomon Schaffman.
Where did you get that?
I owned the book. What do you want out of me? I'm allowed to own the book, right or wrong? I owned the book. I didn't have to get it from... No student had to send it on to me. No student had to drive Sherry crazy. Baruch Hashem. I own the book. It's a fabulous book. Very fascinating. A lot of typos. When you read the book, it's before computerization and computer checks. Today, you read a book, there are no typos because the computer picks it up unless it's a word in the wrong place. In other words, if the word makes sense, the computer will not pick it up. But when you have a typo, the computer picks it up. When you write a Hebrew transliteration, the computer will underline it. You do the spell check. What kind of word is this? You follow me? Nidchei Yisrael. The computer never heard of Nidchei Yisrael.
That's the name of the synagogue.
I understand.
You asked the question of the name of the synagogue.
That's one of the synagogues that he ministered to in Baltimore. Now, what is fascinating is nothing has changed. My student, Rabbi Steve Przanski, Shmuel Przanski, you all know the name. You got to remember, Mario, he's rabbi in Tinek. This is heavyweight. He fought a big battle with Abe Foxman. You know the name Abe Foxman? And presents the one, Abe Foxman from the ADL, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. And he took on Przanski, little Przanski, big Abe Foxman. Przanski won. That battle reached the New York Times. Kol hakavod. Przanski, Steve is Steve. Kol hakavod lo. I have a very unique relationship. I yet knew his great-grandparents. I have met his grandchildren, and I yet knew his great-grandparents. So put together how many generations. So he had a piece that appeared. He has a blog, a website, whatever you call it. I don't know. I'm not that. What should I call it? A blog?
Blog.
What's the difference between a blog to a website? A blog is what?
A column that you write.
On your website, but it has to be on your website. You have a special website. I mean, he has a blog on his website. A blog, he lets the world know what he thinks. And he draws a lot of fire. And Steve is fabulous. I have to tell you that I mean, 99% of what he says I'm in agreement with. He's very sharp. I can't be as sharp as he is. But that's my nature, it's my personality. I'm a Talmud of the Rav, so you know, you see, I can finish the shiur and give a very strong opinion and tell you, but there are other points of view too, because the Rav taught us to think dialectically. Steve is not a Talmud of the Rav. He studied in Far Rockaway, studied with me here in BMT, and he has, you can look it up, October 12th, 2012, he's talking about the kids that go to general college. A study was just done, and the study shows within a few years, 50% of the kids from the finest day schools, the finest yeshiva high schools, the kids are no longer from. And he goes in, why are children who got the best education, why aren't they from? And part of it, he says, is they observe their parents and how their parents daven. I have noticed that there are teens who simply do not daven. They will converse the whole time. And invariably, they are the children of fathers who themselves don't stop talking in shul. Children who roam the halls of the synagogue on Shabbat morning are invariably the offsprings of parents who roam the hall like father, like son. And what can I tell you? Let's take Woodmere as an example. Look what happened in the Young Israel. I remember in Israel of Woodmere. I used to daven there very often because there was a family, they know the greater family, the Gluck brothers. No one is left in the last remnant just sold his house in Woodmere. So I'd be there for Shabbos. Davened at the main minyan. What a mob scene. The noise level. It's unbelievable. You might think you're at Yankee Stadium and Joe DiMaggio, Daniel just hit a home run. The noise level. Then they come into daven. Kriyas HaTorah. People come in for Musaf. What? Where were you chakras? It's beyond words. And then you see people walking. I'm going to give you one little story that happened to me. The Rav, by the way, has told stories what it was like when he came to Boston. Give you Bididi HaViyuvda. I don't want to mention any names, obviously. I'm sitting with I'm still very friendly with these, my good friends. And right before Kriyat HaTorah, Shabbos morning, guy walks over to him and says, Chaim, we got a chance to buy this stock. Looks good. It's low. We're all going in, 20,000 apiece. You'll join with us? I'll let you know after Kriya. Now, could you imagine Kriya the Torah, what the guy is concentrating on? And Einachinami, right before Maftir, the guy comes back and my friend, I don't want to mention his name, Chaim Yankel, says, I'm in with you. Count me in. 20 grand, I'm in. Now, what happened as a result of that? That gave birth to an unbelievable shul. What is it called? And tell the class, Ellie. No? Rabbi Eish Kaidish? I know. They saw what happened, Eish Kaidish. That's how it be. Am I right or wrong? It was a breakaway, and in order to become my student there is the rabbi slash the Rebbe. You have no idea who Moshe Weinberger is. Oh boy, he effizikli a Rebbe, 100%. And in order to join that shul, you had to sign a pledge you wouldn't speak. Now, so the young Israel took itself by the horns, and they already have to have gabayim, you're not allowed to speak, there's now social pressure, don't disgrace the service, and as Eli Wagner says so properly, young Israel of Woodmere is different today. Agreed. Gentlemen, nothing has changed. What Pruzansky describes is exactly what Rabbi Rice and Rabbi Lisa, and this is America, and this is a shul. And I'll tell it to you with a joke that we heard when we were kids. I think we mentioned the joke in class, or we mentioned it elsewhere. Again, I don't know where I tell all my jokes, but this is when we were kids. So we always, the New York was filled with Catholic schools. It's not like today. Today, no one believes in anything. But in the 40s, people were good Catholics. So in my house, either you went to Solanto or you went to a Catholic parochial school. You're going to a Catholic school, kids are so quiet. Going to yeshiva, what noise, what yelling, what running, shouting, pushing, shoving. What's the difference? In a Catholic school, Yashka is on the wall, on the cross, bleeding. The kid is frightened stiff. Do you go into yeshiva? No, Baruch Hashem, no Yashka, no bleeding, no cross, no crucifix. You go into a church. The whole service is less than an hour. A mass. 1 hour. Mass. Go past the church. Catholic church. Latin. My days was all in Latin. They wouldn't reform Jews yet. They didn't daven in English. Only in Latin. 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. Three masses. Every mass has to end 9 o'clock. By 9:50, you're out. The yashas have to clean up, set it up. 10 o'clock, 10:50, you're out. So that's number one. A church service is much quicker. Number two, a church service, what did the minister speak about? Life and death and hell and punishment and Dante's Inferno. No, now you're going to a shul and find them davening halb nine. You start davening 8:30. You got it. Who's going to get the aliyahs? Who's going to get maftir? Ve'hata yotzait? Ve'hata chasana? Who wants to make a bishabarech v'achayla kranka? I have guys in my shul this morning, my word of honor, we had 25 people at the 5:30 minyan. It's unbelievable. The 6 o'clock minyan barely has a minyan. And we're overflowing. I don't know what happened this morning. I told them afterwards it was an American minyan. So one of the Israelis says, yeah, everyone here is with an American accent. Nah, I'm not talking about the accent. There were too many cottage suckers. We must have had 5 cottage suckers. It was like an American minyan. You follow me, Sam? Too many people saying cottage. One of them an Englishman, Danny Kitzberg, if you know the name. He lost his mother recently, very recently. So in our shuls, it's long. We're at home. This is Hamish. The rabbi's going to get up and tell jokes. No, everyone is talking, everyone is making noise. And here's the description on page 188. I couldn't believe my eyes that Rabbi Rice is complaining when they reach the Haftorah, half the men already are walking out. No, what does that remind you of? What's the latest invention, innovation on the American scene? The Kiddush Club. You don't know this, Yosef. You go into the big shuls, suddenly, before the Haftorah, 30 people walk out, 40 people, other people snuck. I've been in shuls, I've been in Kiddush clubs. Ribbono shel Olam, and they take out my grandchildren, drive me crazy. They were scotch, and you got to know what to drink, and there's a black label, a red label, a blue label, a green label, and we're talking prices are unbelievable. This is nothing new. Here it is in the 1840s, the 1850s. Here he describes the shul in Baltimore. I mean, you again, I saw this. You had a shul. So what did you have? You had the heat. How did you make heat? Remember, you're living in a different world. Electric heating, air conditioning heating. Now in New York, there's no heating whatsoever. Without electricity, you don't know what's going on. It is tragic. It's not just one or two. It's unbelievable. I spoke with people, dear friends in their 80s. They were freezing. The death toll keeps on rising. So he describes the shul in Baltimore. There was a big stove, and half the balabatim were standing around the stove talking politics, talking narishkeit, while the chazan is davening up front. And he, the description of the women is unbelievable. I couldn't make this up if I wanted to. Page 189, that the women come in, and one of them has like what he calls opera glasses, what we would call binoculars. I think opera glasses, they still use the term, but binoculars. And she's watching what the men are doing, and she's telling all the yentas around her what the men are doing. Beginning on page 190, it takes me back to my days as a student. Younger than you, I told you in my days, you got kicked out of the yeshiva at the age of 23. Either you knew how to learn or you'd be an amaretz all your life. It's not like today that Moshe's a little bit older than 23 and he's still trying to climb the ladder of learning. In my days, either by 23 you made it or forget it. You'll never make it. No kollel, no nothing. Kicked you out into the big world. So our professor of homiletics, we had teachers. Kanai and Hara, no one wrote open letters to commentator about our teachers. Little Joe Luxton, Haskell's father, the man who built the Upper East Side, the man who built the Hilas Jeshurun, the man who built Ramaz, that the Rav would look at Joe Luxton and say, here's my role model for Maimonides, quote, end quote. And Joe Luxton tells us, little Joe, when I came to Kehillat Jeshurun to assist my grandfather, the revered Rabbi Ramaz, Reb Moshe Zvulun Margolis, for whom Ramaz is named, I had my biggest battle with the congregants over the spittoons. No, you don't even know what a spittoon is? I saw with my own eyes that in back it is the guy. It was unbelievable. And here in Baltimore, the spittoons at the Baltimore Hebrew congregation were not removed. Then Rabbi Reich, this is unbelievable, he says, he gets up to preach a sermon. He says, what am I going to preach about? If I talk about Tarat Mishpacha, that the women should observe and go to mikvah, I'm told, Rabbi, we don't talk about that in public in America, but that men and women can flirt with each other and wink to each other across the mechitza, that they can do in America? Anyway, I could go on and on with his description. He was very frustrated and very hurt and very aggravated. He left the rabbinate. He maintained the shul in his house. He maintained dominion. He gave shayurim, but everything was done privately. As a matter of fact, in 1847, he began to give a shiur and a sermon once a month in English, 1847. Once a month, began to give the shiur in English. People loved it. People worshipped him. People followed him around. But he made a living. He was a businessman. He was dealing in silk and material fabrics that people would buy and manufacture. Later, he found it too hard to keep on going to New York to buy up the wares. He had heart problems, so he opened a grocery store. He did everything possible not to make a living out of the rabbinate. However, time and again the proposal came up, make him chief rabbi of the United States. Four different times, I can actually give you the years, not that it's important, but four different times this proposal was made, and made seriously, 1840, 1845, 1849, and 1862, right near the end of his life. Now why? Why did they make this proposal? Because as distant and as far away each community was from the other community, every Orthodox shul in America knew there was a Rav, a Talmud Chacham, in Baltimore. Questions came in to him from all over the United States. People no longer turned to the chief rabbi of the British Empire, at that time Rabbi Adler, because they had an American rabbi. Not only that, Rabbi Adler, when he received the question from America, now referred the question to Rabbi Rice. You have a Rav in America, you have a Talmud Chacham in America, ask him your questions. And it was a beautiful thought to take this man, give him an important title, give him a decent salary, take him out of business ventures, let him worship in his house and continue with the shul in his apartment, or it might have been already a one-family house with the shul in part of his house, let him visit other synagogues, be received once a month here, once a month there, let him be the chief rabbi. And every time this proposal came up, it fell through the floor. For one simple reason. America in the 19th century was the Wild West. Have you studied American history? Go west, young man. And what does the Wild West mean? You do what you want. There's no law and order. You conquer. You build. You mine. You set up manufacturing. You import. You export. The Wild West was America. This was the American dream. This built America. America begins on the little East Coast, and we wind up today with a tremendous country from coast to coast. Who built it? Who went? And part of that dream, yes, you couldn't shoot and kill at will. There were outlaws and Indians, and there were sheriffs, and you all know the movies, the Wild Western movies that have been made. I can tell you that the Rav loved Westerns. This is what I'm told, that when he watched a TV movie, when he had to escape from reality, he loved cowboy and Indian Westerns. That's what I'm told by people who were close to the family. Okay, that was the West. That was the Wild West. To accept authority went against the American grain. And documented here in the doctorate, in this doctorate, time and again, they would declare, we want a chief rabbi. 6, 7, 8 other rabbis spoke up. What do you mean a chief rabbi? What is this, Europe? We have to surrender our authority? And remember, all over the communities where Jews came into America, they were bogus rabbis. It's the old story. He documents it here, but I saw it in my own time. What is America? It's an ingathering of exiles. Well, I remember Bnei Akiva. We had one Madrich who was a survivor. I don't want to mention the name. It's a very famous family. He didn't live long. He survived, but his life was shortened. He claimed the title Rabbi Doctor. Okay? So we used to ask him, where did you get smicha? Gave us names in Hungary. Where's your smicha? Got lost. Concentration camp. Where'd you get your doctorate? Gave us some university place in Romania, Czechoslovakia. No. Go and prove it. People came from America, and he gives examples here, put up shingles, rabbi, mohel, shaychet, whatever you want. There were kolbos. We'll do whatever you want. We have degrees. We're capable. Each one. You have stories. The sign painters. It's the famous joke. A guy puts up a sign, Chief Rabbi of the United States. Who made you Chief Rabbi? The sign painter. Or the other answer, let the United States get together and dispose me. If they don't like me as Chief Rabbi, they should vote me out. And this was the tragedy, that every time they came up with the plan, and many times they were so well-meaning, and it would have been so good to have a focal, central figure in the United States. Every time they came up with a plan, it could never get off the floor. This was America.
Who were the people that were opposing
this? The Balabatim, Orthodox people, Orthodox Rabbanim, people in Baltimore, people in New York. The man was known. People in Cincinnati, letters coming into him all the time, questions. He was the focal address. He was the Reb Moshe Feinstein of the United States in the 1840s and the 1850s into the early 60s.
Did he quote some of the responses that he addressed himself to?
There's very little left of Rabbi Rice. I'll tell you who did leave response in one moment. But there's very little left as far as Rabbi Rice goes. Whatever the reasons are, not everything survives. But he was the focal person. No, to the best of my knowledge, there's no major chapter on response per se in Schaffman's doctorate. Which tells you that very little survived. Archives, you have to find archives, you have to find correspondence. Very little survived. Now,
is there a Jewish, in the Jewish community in Baltimore, do they have like a Jewish library?
They held the 150th anniversary of his death, so evidently they're well aware that Rabbi Rice was the first Orthodox rabbi to have smicha to come to the United States. Does anything survive? I doubt it, but Charlie, you can check it out. Ask Eli Schlesberg. He's on top of the community. If there's an archive, if there's anything in writing, I doubt it. If there would be something, we would have a volume, we would have a book, we would have something tangible.
About, what was it, 60, 70 years ago, there was a rabbi, no, he wasn't a rabbi, from Israel, Dr. Israel Petros. He went to Baltimore, started Hebrew College.
Correct, correct. So, but what does Ephros have to do with Rice?
Maybe there might be
it has to be checked. It has to be checked. But what's fascinating is, what issue becomes very big by the 1850s? Where is Baltimore caught up? The slavery issue. Baltimore is part of Maryland. You're talking about the Mason-Dixon line. They're right on the border. And this issue became a tremendous question of controversy. And here it's very fascinating. Rabbi Bernard Illoway. The name mean anything? Let me spell the name. Illoway. His years 1814 to 1871. He followed Rabbi Rice to America. Rabbi Illoway was also a big Talmud Chacham. In addition to being a big Talmud Chacham, he had a doctorate, which is very fascinating. A Talmud of the, you know the family?
Yeah, my son-in-law is descended from.
Yeah, right, they're still...
His mother now tells me all that.
Right, right, no, he was a terrific Talmud Chacham with a PhD. And he was fluent in English. He didn't have to learn English. And he was very close to Rabbi Rice. What's fascinating is when the machloket broke out about slavery, Rabbi Rice was basically opposed, which made him popular with a large segment of the Orthodox community in Baltimore. And Rabbi Ulloway was not opposed to slavery. He gave a famous talk in opposition to the Union, to the Eastern Seaboard, to Washington, to Lincoln, that they dare to go to war, to Grant, that they dare to go to war over slavery. Why are we killing one, killing the other? And he makes reference to the fact that the Bible has slavery. And Ulloway immediately was offered the rabbinate of New Orleans. They loved him. No, this is true. New Orleans had a large Orthodox shul. It's not a simple matter, because in New Orleans, a lot of Jews settled and did business until today. I don't have to tell you, with the flooding, there were Orthodox shuls. The Rabbi Leibel Dulitz, who taught in YU for so many decades, was a New Orleans product. And Bernard Ulloway becomes the second well-known Orthodox rabbi in the United States. Now, he wrote his svarim, we have. He wrote responsa, he answered questions. As long as Rabbi Rice was alive, Ulloway was subservient to Rabbi Rice. With the death of Rabbi Rice, and Ulloway outlives him by about 9 years, he had a short life, he was the focal figure in the United States. So between these two giants, we have the first Orthodox rabbis in America. Both of them were considered, by the way, with Ulloway too, occasionally the title of chief rabbi came up, but it could not happen in the United States. Towards the end of his life, Rabbi Rice could no longer remain in business. He had heart trouble. Running a grocery store was difficult. People pleaded with him, come back to the rabbinate. In New York, one of his big supporters and one of the famous Orthodox rabbanim at the time, Rabbi Morris Raphael, it's probably Raphael, but spelled in English, R-A-P-H-A-L-L, he had a different idea. What had tremendous influence at that time? The written word. He wanted to start an Orthodox weekly paper in New York in German, Judo-German, and he wanted Rabbi Rice to be the main contributor, move to New York, and they would have influence through the newspaper on Jews throughout the United States, even if he couldn't be chief rabbi, but at least through the newspaper, his influence would be felt. But ultimately, he was ill, couldn't leave Baltimore. He had a son-in-law who was a chazan in Baltimore, and he agreed to come back to become rabbi of the Baltimore Hebrew congregation. Came back, gave a fabulous sermon, spoke about the fact that he is committed to Torah Shebichtav and Torah Sheba'alpeh, and that his balabatim have to understand he's not going to compromise, he's not going to be reform, and the balabatim welcomed him with joy. They were happy to have him back officially in the active rabbinate, and that Pesach, the last Pesach of his life, with the war raging, war to free the slaves, Rabbi Rose spoke about the Pesach holiday as being a universal holiday, the biblical theme of going from slavery to freedom. And the Orthodox Jews were by and large anti-slavery, idolized him. It was, wow, the rabbi is back, the rabbi is here, the rabbi is preaching, the rabbi is speaking, and the rabbi has a message that is so potent and powerful. And that's the way life works. He finally found his niche. He finally found balabatim. He was able to synthesize being a Hungarian Bavarian Talmud Chacham, or I should say a German Bavarian Talmud Chacham, and being a proud American. And that very year, he dies in the hands of one of his biggest Hasidim. It's a family that lives on in Baltimore, I believe, until today. His personal physician, Dr. Aaron Friedenwald, the Friedenwald family. Are they still in Baltimore? I know that they're named, their institution's named in their memory. And this is Rabbi Rice. Rabbi Yulaway then becomes the leading rabbi in the United States. Okay? That's the story. Achievement, but sad. It's still America. Civil War changes the face of America. East European Jewry wakes up. They start pouring in. The East European Jew already, it's much more traditional, by and large, much more observant than the Bavarian Jew, than the Hungarian Jew, than the German Jew. He will not assimilate so quickly. They settle in every community you can imagine, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, Detroit. But the biggest settlement, of course, is the east side of New York. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands. Primitive living conditions. They give you tours today on the east side. I don't need a tour. I remember going to visit my aunt, great aunt and great uncle. Must be 1940, one of my earliest memories of life. And the bathrooms were in the hallways. You didn't have any toilet in every apartment, in the hallway. And that already was an achievement because there were other homes, tenements on the east side where the bathrooms were out, an outhouse in back of the tenement. Could you imagine in the middle of the night you have to go to the bathroom and you have to get dressed and go downstairs? Hashem Yirachem. My mother always said, Zichrono Levracha, Reni Kaparat Mishkava, my mother always said to me, the greatest invention that she saw in her life is that bathrooms, sanitary plumbing within the house. And you know, we take it for granted. And my mother always said, you know, I always thought, what's the greatest invention? My mom, what did you see? Airplanes. Today, a computer. I mean, I'm overwhelmed by what a computer is. It puts us all out of business. Everyone can be a big Talmud Chacham in a minute flat with a computer. You just have to know how to punch what keys. So they're crowded on the east side. But you see, these people, the difficulty in adjusting was difficult. But they saw their kids. And the kids already are Americanized. The kids speak English. And you have to remember, language is a basic function of acculturation. If you don't speak, Israel's the only place in the world where you can live in Israel all your life and be successful and not learn a word of Hebrew. All right? Well, they're little enclaves here. People speak only English. In Rehavia, Katamon today, you walk the streets, 90% of the conversations are in French. You go to Gilo, people speak Russian. You have TV, you know, cable TV, you have programs in every language you want. There are Russian news where, if not for the fact there's an Israeli flag behind the people speaking, the broadcasters, you could think you're in Russia. All right, today the Americans all know Hebrew. It's a different America. At one time when we came in Aliyah, there used to be a program in English. You heard the news in English. I came, I already knew basic Hebrew. I just had to make the adjustment to modern Hebrew. But I never listened to English news. From the day I came, I could listen to Israeli news, the Hebrew news. But you have to understand, language is critically important. Israel is a country of immigrants. So anyone with seichel, like I said yesterday after class, anyone with seichel, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, they already will know Hebrew and their English will be a third language, a second language. But it's a process. It's a country of immigrants. Thank God there are more immigrants coming in. And you go to Machon Lev, you can hear every language taught. You go to Mir, you go to Mir Yeshiva, you have Shurim in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in English, in French, in Russian. What else? I don't know. There might even be in Spanish, for all I know there. Chabura, in every language. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Baruch Hashem. But this is an exception. In America, my mother-in-law's Zichronet Tzadeket Levracha, my mother-in-law told me the most embarrassing moment of her life was in school. My mother-in-law was born in America in 1906, I believe. 1908, was born in America. And she used the word in school, in public school, where your teacher was God. She used the word, I have to look, my mother-in-law said, at my calendar. Calendar is Yiddish for calendar. Ich darf gucken in mein Kalender. Calendar. She used the word by mistake. Everyone laughed at her. Everyone mocked her. So you see, these kids on the east side are Americanizing. There's a famous book of the ghetto. It was written by a Gentile, by a social worker. I quoted in my work on Rebel. You can see what I'm talking about. But it could be I quoted in Silver too. I don't recall. But they tell a story that this Gentile who knew Yiddish observes the following scene, that the father, the East European father, says to the kid, mein Zun, kum mit mir zu daven in Marav, come with me to shul to daven Marav. And the kid says to his father, what you giving me? What will you pay me to go daven Marav? And the father had to give the kid a penny. A penny was money then. You got a candy for a penny. A penny was still money in my time. I remember Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Volk, used to learn with his son Benny. And if Benny didn't know the Tosfot, we could hear in the Beis Medrash, we could hear Rav Volk. He started in Baltimore, running away from Hitler, the late 30s. He began in Baltimore, and then Rabbi Revel brought him to New York. And we could hear Rabbi Volk saying, poor Benny, no penny. You follow me? He didn't know the Tosfot. Poor Benny, no penny, but a penny was money. The kid wouldn't daven, go with his father to daven unless he got paid. See, that shows you already the Americanization. The father talks Yiddish, the kid answers in good English, and what is the kid interested in? In America, with money you get honey. Without money, you get nothing. Today's a different America with Obama. Baruch Hashem, it's a communist America. Everyone gets everything. Chinam, ein kesef. But we're talking America. So these Jews on the east side were suffering. And some of them, and listen to me very carefully, not all of them were schlamassels. Jews came and they were frum. And they made money. You follow me, Josh? They had money. They had stores. They were manufacturers. They were involved in the building trade. Not everyone was a schlamassel. Some of them were people of means. And they cared. They cried. What will be with our children? They were concerned. Not all, not the majority. I don't have to tell you the Rav's Torah about this, and we'll talk about Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, but not for now. The minority, but they were concerned. Now, everyone in America looked to the British Empire as a role model. Sam, do you know what was said 150 years ago? The sun never set on the British Empire. You heard that expression? No matter where you were, Canada, Australia, no matter how long, 24 hours, there was always a part of the British Empire that the sun was out. The sun never set on the British Empire. God save the Queen. The Jews there was amazing. Almost every synagogue was an Orthodox synagogue. England, Canada, Australia, South Africa. That was amazing. Now, it's true. By and large, the overwhelming majority of the Jews were not total Shomer Shabbos. But at least there was a feeling of tradition. And they perpetuated it. They were able to give it to their children. Until today. You all know that the big contest in England, more important than Obama or Romney, or more important that will happen here, who will be the next chief rabbi of the British Empire? Will it be an American? Will it be a British homegrown product? Doesn't look like it. Maybe a South African, I'm told.
South African.
Excuse me? They tell me one of the rabbis in London, who's extremely popular, if I recall, my Talmud explained to me, he's a South African, grew up in South Africa. And he's an important candidate because a lot of the Balabatim feel they need an Englishman, someone who knows from within what England's about. What's beautiful about Rabbi Soloveitchik is, of course, he's a master speaker. And he has the name Soloveitchik. Could be the Haredim will honor him because of who his great-great-grandfather was. On the other hand, Rabbi Broid is a fabulous Talmud Chacham, but he will not let anyone step on him in learning. In other words, the Haredi world has in Rabbi Broid someone that's going to answer them very strongly when they step out of line with Narishkeit. But I don't have to elaborate.
The RGC just quoted looking for a new assistant rabbi. I don't know. You put one of them together there.
Yeah, Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblatt was mentioned as a candidate. He's my student, okay. Halavai. Also, who's he married to? Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik's great-great-granddaughter, Baruch Hashem.
The
Rav's great-grandson-in-law, Baruch Hashem. But it's interesting because there's a lot of, a lot has to be said. Listen, I'm going to give it to you on a very simple level. Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha, became rabbi of the Jewish Center. He's one of the finest products that came out of Anglo-Jewry. Did you ever hear him speak? Did you ever see the man's knowledge? But he got up and cracked a joke in Jewish Center. That was the end of his rabbinate there. Because these big shots from Jewish Center, old-time yekes, they don't like jokes in the middle of sermons. You understand? It's a different mentality. So you have to know the mentality. You can't get... He's no longer alive, but he was there for a year or two, whatever it was. It's a sad story. It was a different mentality. Today, if you've studied in Israel, you're exposed to Americans. So it's a little bit different today, a little bit better. But anyway, be it as it may, the chief rabbinate of England, look what they have accomplished. And look, you take Rabbi Hertz... Look at his chumash, look at his siddur. The man was a giant. You take Rabbi Sacks, look at that man's works on philosophy, look at his English, sermons, translation, siddur. Take Rabbi Jacobowitz, medical ethics. And I could go on and on, Rabbis Adler, Nathan, Marcus, each one was a figure that you could be proud of.
Even the brother of Sarah Rosh.
Rabbi Heschel Levine, but that's ancient history.
Right.
So you see, the Jew on the east side dreamt maybe what we need is a chief rabbinate. And all this talk that we heard in the 1840s and 1850s about particularly Rabbi Rice, to a more minor degree about Rabbi Illoway, because if it didn't work with Rabbi Rice, why should it work with Rabbi Illoway? And you can check with your family, check what they know, if there's more to what I'm saying. It could be. But on the east side, their vision was more humble. It's not going to be a chief rabbi of the United States. It's going to be a chief rabbi, or what they call the Rav HaKolel, of the Orthodox shuls in New York City. So it was a more humble vision, and perhaps this will solve our problem. A great Rav, a posek, a teacher, a preacher, a leader, and who'll do for us what they did in England. He'll establish an ecclesiastical court, that means a basin. There'll be a network of synagogues, there'll be cooperation, there'll be publications. Fascinating what they were dreaming of. Okay? In order to bring this dream to fruition, you need money. They had money. You'll see, I'll give you names next week. They're Balabatan, who were willing to put up thousands upon thousands of dollars. There are good Jews in this world. I can tell you one little story that just happened now. There's a Sephardic Jew who has a butcher shop. I believe it's in Long Beach. A poor guy who opened a real kosher butcher shop, and his whole world was destroyed. The butcher shop washed away. Tens of thousands of dollars worth of meat in the freezers. Everything washed away. And he's sitting on the floor and crying. One of our Jews walked in, who buys by him when he's in Long Beach. And he had come to check on what happened to his house. And he says to the man, "I'm writing you out a check for $10,000. He says, "I figured out I generally buy $10,000 worth of meat from you over the summer months when we entertain. This is in advance for next summer." He refused to accept the check. But look at the greatness of this philanthropist, willing on the spot to write out a check for $10,000. I know more stories like this. They're great people in our world. Don't think because people are wealthy, they're not great. Some of these wealthy people are not arrogant, and they're absolute B'nai Torah and absolute great. Who gives all the Sifrei Torah you know of? No, give me the name. The man who gives Sifrei Torah every year, makes parties, built Nativ Meir. What's that? Ira Rennett. Nativ Aryeh, Rabbi Rennett, I taught his sons in BMT. What a man. His whole life is giving Sifrei Torah. I'll tell you a little story about him. Told you the story. This girl getting married from a Haredi home. Her father died. There was no money. She was, I think she was the kindergarten teacher in Ramaz. And at her wedding, the Haredi Chatan wanted more money, and there's no one to put it up. This man wrote out a check on the spot, $25,000, that the wedding should go on.
Did the marriage continue?
I believe so.
Such a person?
I believe so. But it's, why do you look at the evil man, look at the good man? Look at the good man. So you have to understand. No, she was on in years. I know the story. I heard it from eyewitnesses. And they were blown away by the generosity and the goodness of Ira Rennett's heart. God bless him. So, money was put up. And then, who do you choose? And you have to understand, Americans, what is democracy? Why was Rabbi Rice so impressed with American democracy? Why was Yosef Begun so impressed with Israeli democracy? You have freedom of choice. You don't have that in Russia. You didn't have that in Europe. In Israel, any Tom, Dick, and Harry can organize a party, as you see what's going on right now with the elections. It's fabulous. It's unbelievable. Every kook can jump ahead. Every genius, every dreamer. Fabulous. Then you have the election, and then the within 2 weeks you forgot already who was running. America, choice. The Jews started thinking, who do they turn to? And it was, I would say, unanimous. No? Can anyone tell me who wrote a Perush and Chumash that even Art Scroll has to quote, But Obstgrill doesn't tell you that he was put into Cheirim for having a PhD. You've all learned this Perush, the Malbim. Right or wrong, Reb Meir Leibush Ben Yechiel here, the famous Malbim, a giant of Torah, a Talmud Chacham par excellence. He wrote Svarim, if you're familiar with his work, on Aruch Chaim, a gon adir. People criticized him. Why did you waste time writing such a Perush on Tanakh? Why didn't you write, continue writing on Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch? And he answered, because there's so much irreligiousness already. He was fighting the Maskilim. No one is going to look at my parish on Dalet Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, but my parish on Malbim may help everyone understand Chaf Dalet Svarim and Torah Shebechav and Torah Shebal Peh. The Malbim. Oh, what a choice. He had a doctorate. He was a giant. The very fact that the Malbim would have come to America, set foot in America, people would have blown away awe, reverence. B'nei Mazal Yisrael, the Gemara in Shabbos. We have no mazal. The Malbim elected, started closing down his European operation. He was Rabbi in Bucharest, 1879, started to make arrangements to come to New York City, and right in the middle had a heart attack and died. And that ended the saga of the Malbim. From that point on, the story of New York chief rabbi, one long story of endless frustration, consternation, and aggravation, as we will see. So to reiterate, all right, I believe it was an interesting shiur today, yep. And all I can say is, check it out. I'm very happy that Morty has relatives from Rabbi Illoway. How do they relate to you? It's your son?
My wife at tennis school.
Your mother-in-law.
My
Who your children are married to? Your machatenista. Catherine. Catherine. Oh my gosh, Catherine Illoway. Wow. So you see, that family still has from Jews. I've yet to come across a rice. Ask Ellie if there are any rices left. Anyone from the family? Weinberger, I see from the comments on his grave, there's Kvarim, you know, and I see the comments. I got to thank, by the way, my student, David Katz. David, he works for Satma today, so I don't know if they allow him to listen to his Rebbe, but if they still allow you to listen, your Rebbe thanks you because you taught him how to use a computer. He was insistent, I have to learn, and now I have to control myself, not becoming a slave to the computer. Got to keep on learning Shas and Paiskim and not just play games with the computer. But I see from the comments that Weinberger has relatives who are Shomrei Torah Mitzvah, great-great-grandchildren, etc. But it's a fascinating story. Rice, a real Talmud Chacham. 150 years since he died, still remembered. It shows you something, that the Baltimore community still remembers him. Illoway is a story unto himself. He had many rabbinates. He was a very interesting individual. He winds up in Cincinnati. Cincinnati was a major city. And in Cincinnati, that's where his main rabbinate was. But New Orleans is very well remembered because of the slavery issue. And then, when all is said and done, and the Americanization and the Thanksgiving, very fascinating. And then New York, what a story. The Malbim would have been fabulous, but we have no muscle. And you'll see what happens next. I want to end off by telling you what great sinners I am and Rabbi Rubin, and it goes back to Rabbi Rubin's comment at the last moment of class last Monday when I spoke about when push comes to shove, I have more in common with the Haredim than the Jew who is a Mechallel Shabbos.
Who sent
and Rabbi Rubin came out and attacked that statement and differed, which is his privilege. But I want to say to Rabbi Rubin, we are at fault. You know why? Because what's a Haredi? He's afraid to come out of the ghetto. You have to understand him. He looks at Mendelssohn. He looks what happened with Mendelssohn. He's afraid to come out of the ghetto. How much assimilation? How many goyim are walking the world today who are direct descendants of Jews? Where are Marx's great-grandchildren? Where are Engels' great-grandchildren? We have a miracle with Trotsky. Trotsky's great-grandson lives in Hebron today. Bornstein took back the original name of the family. God bless him. But we have to be an example that you can come out of the ghetto, you can be a Gaon, you can be a Tzaddik, you can be a Chassid, and you don't have to be afraid of the big world. And we have set a bad example. Because if our example would be good, Kazera Eva Kadesh, they should follow us. Okay. Gentlemen, if anyone here, I have a good gizak. Baruch Hashem in ancient Chinese. I gave Danny, because Danny's uncle is in here. If anyone is interested, one time in YU here, we had a real institution going. And one night, we had a night when I came in to YU, we had a fabulous basketball team. And being a young kid, I worshipped the ground that the Gedolei Moshe Ba'aretz, the great basketball players of that era, played. As a matter of fact, here we are watching a game, and I actually believe that I'm in this picture. I think this is me right over here in the first row with my mouth covered. So we had a night here where all the old timers, not all of them are alive anymore, came out. This is what they looked like 60 years ago approximately. And here, this young man is world famous today. Rakefet chokes on him, but there are many people who consider him the giant of giants. That is David Hartman, okay? Danny Schumann's great uncle, is it? I have it right. There he is, David Hartman. Here's, these are all good friends, were good friends of mine. Here's a sucker who had the misfortune of meeting me outside the OU Center a few weeks ago on Friday, and I said to him, this is Marvin Hershkowitz, and I said to him, Marvin, do you have my new book? And he didn't even know. I said, what, you don't have Washington? How can you breathe there? And the poor guy had to go in with me to the OU Center and buy the book where I signed it. So if anyone wants a copy, it's yours. But honor this. Don't throw it away. And if we need more copies, I happen to have more copies, of course. When all this came to an end, they started throwing everything out in this building. So I took a stack of this. I said, this cannot be thrown out. Maybe one day a student will appreciate it. Furthermore, here is the articles on homosexuality. If anyone is interested, this is top scholarship, the New York Times article, and then the research article. And here is Rabbi Przanski's article. And with that, I want to tell you that in my entire life, I will never give a shiur like I'm going to give this Sunday, where I show you how a classmate of mine is a genius of geniuses. And I throw down everything I've said until now and knock it out the door. Now, for the Kollel per se, and now I'm very serious. This coming Sunday, I will shift gears. We finished up Minhag. And I'm going into how to paskin halacha. If you're serious Talmidei Chachamim, not only should you come to Sunday's class, but each one should bring two other guys from the Kollel, because 40, 50, 60 years from now, you will thank me for the shurim I'm about to start giving. How to paskin? What is it all about? How do we make a decision? What are the klalim? What does the Kuntres HaShach have to say? How do we explain it? How do we deal with Reb Moshe? What is the B'diyevet? What is the Lachat Chila? What is the new manuscript? How do we deal with the Chazon Ish? Gentlemen, give us a chance to teach and make the world a little wiser. Until we meet again next Sunday and Monday in health and happiness, Das Verdanya. Thank you very much.